Welcome to Local Talk on KHUI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm Kay Potter, one of your hosts for today, together with my co-host, Ursula Rudenberg. Hello, Ursula. How are you enjoying the snow?
Very much. Thank you, Kay. My Thanksgiving festivities have started early. My nieces and my sister and brother-in-law are down from Pittsburgh, up from Pittsburgh. In fact, my brother-in-law is here with us this morning in the studio. And I had a beautiful, beautiful walk yesterday with my 9-year-old niece in Brookside Park. Very beautiful. Thank you, weather. We've got two very interesting but very different topics for today. In the second half of the show, we'll be talking with Jinwa Alameen, an instructor in the Arabic language program at Iowa State. Jinwa is originally from Syria, and she's been recently in the news because she was reinstated to her position at Iowa State University after some bureaucratic delays which caused trouble with her work permit and put an end to her teaching for a while at Iowa State. And her students missed her, and they were very instrumental in her reinstatement. A very interesting story of students taking action. And we'll be hearing that story and also more about the Arabic language program later in the hour. But for the first part of our program, we'd like to welcome our first guest, Alicia Krabel. Hi, Alicia. And she's an expert on hospice from Mary Greeley Medical Center. Welcome to KHUI and to Local Talk, Alicia.
Thank you for having me.
Kay, I believe that you and Alicia will be continuing a topic that you began to discuss earlier in this month with Joni Williams, a colleague of hers.
That's right. And Joni is an expert in palliative care, whereas Alicia's an expert in the topic of hospice. And I hope Alicia will explain the difference in those two. But the whole topic is one I'm calling the importance of having those difficult conversations. And so, Alicia, I'd like to ask you what you think of this, what I'm just going to say, as a short way to introduce this topic. I'd like our listeners to imagine that a close friend or relative is terminally ill, and they need to ask the dying person this question. Would you prefer to go home now and be with your family, or would you rather stay here in the hospital and continue treatment? Would that be a good introduction to this topic, would you say?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And to start with, could you just explain the difference between, or how palliative care and hospice are related? I believe palliative care is the umbrella term.
It is, because palliative care is a type of care that can be provided from the very start of any chronic illness, such as congestive heart failure. At the very diagnosis, you can begin to start talking about palliative care and what your goals are and what you want to happen as your disease progresses.
So it's not necessary for old people.
Basically
relieving discomfort.
It's relieving discomfort, symptom management, different tests and different things to see what your goals are and what the lifelong.
Alicia, what is your position at Mary Greeley?
I am the hospice care coordinator. Mm-hmm. So I arrange and do referrals and have our staff go out and begin the hospice conversation with patients and families.
When you say do referrals, what does that mean in real life?
Well, that means that either a physician, a family member, or a friend, staff from a nursing home facility call us and say, we have this patient that we think is appropriate for hospice care. So I either will go out or arrange for another staff member to go out and visit with the family and the patient, see what their goals are, and then call the physician and see if this is an appropriate referral or an admission for a hospice patient.
And when you say a hospice patient, you're basically referring to somebody who is terminally ill?
Terminally ill.
And then anticipating death.
Correct. Mm-hmm. There are some criteria that we have to meet. The first primary one is the physician has to feel that there's a 6-month or less prognosis for that patient. Their disease will progress as they're expected.
Well, that brings me to the next point. Mm-hmm. If someone is admitted and that is the hospital, the Beth Israel Hospice, that's what people always think of, in, I think, in Ames, on Dakota Avenue. To be admitted to that, you have to have that criterion met, do you?
You do.
Yeah.
You do. Yes, absolutely.
Okay. And that's, I heard you say once before, hospice is not a place.
It is not. It's
right.
not a brick and mortar. It's not a building.
Although
it's
people where might think of that in Ames. It can be a place.
It can be a place, mm-hmm. but it's a philosophy of mm-hmm. care.
Can you explain a little bit?
Well, in order to be in hospice care, yes, there's that criteria. There's a terminal illness. There's a prognosis of 6 months or less. There's different things. But more than that, it's that we focus on comfort and allowing nature to take its course. It's not about tests and poking and prodding. It's just about treating symptoms, but not treating necessarily what's causing the symptoms. Focusing on what the goals are for the patient and the family.
So people can have mm-hmm. hospice care at home, for example.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Homes, nursing homes, assisted living, hospital, wherever the patient is.
So in a way, what you're saying is the focus shifts from curing somebody towards making them comfortable and helping them to prepare for death?
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Because a lot of the treatments that are focused on curing people might be painful and uncomfortable, and they might decide at some point they don't want to continue those treatments.
Yeah, absolutely. We have a lot of patients that, because they have a long-term chronic illness, congestive heart failure, COPD, those types of things, they're in and out of the hospital every week or every 2 weeks, and they just get to the point where they no longer – that's not quality of life for them. So then they want to just remain at home, treat the symptoms, but not go back and forth to the hospital mm-hmm. to have tests.
Mm-hmm. Now, there are standard forms that that I know you're sort of expert on.
Mm-hmm.
Living wills, advanced directives, and in Iowa something called the I-POST.
The I-POST.
Which are quite important for people to think about before way, like, I don't know at what age, but, you know, at any point, actually.
Any point.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because we can die when we're young, too. We'll get a life-threatening illness when we're young. Would you like to talk about some of these standard forms?
They're kind of three different things.
For advanced planning.
Advanced planning involves an advanced directive, and that can be a do not resuscitate. So if your heart stops or you stop breathing, you don't want CPR. A living will is something that you write down. If you have certain illnesses or something happens, like a car accident, these are the things that you want or you don't want, more importantly. CPR, there's some that are in-depth enough that if you want music when you're dying, or if you want a lot of family or you don't want family, they can be very specific. An I-POST is something that has three different, it says who can make decisions
now
for you.
It stands for the, I don't remember, the I stands for Iowa.
Iowa.
I always forget too. But it's something that's unique to Iowa, but it's very specific.
It is. It talks about who can give directions, who can give instructions if you're not able to. It talks about how much treatment you want, all the way from nothing to some to you want everything done. And then it's a physician order. So the order travels with you.
Yeah, I think the P stands for physician, actually.
Yeah, physician ordered. I should have written it down.
Yeah.
This is one of these kind of subtle things about living that very few people actually think about that is quite important.
Absolutely.
And how does somebody actually go about doing that?
You do it at your physician's office.
So it's something that's done through your physician.
Yes, or if you mm-hmm. go into the hospital, Joni does them pretty frequently at the hospital. If you go into the hospital, the physician will ask Joni to go in and start having those conversations. and getting those orders in place. And then that's a living document. It travels with you. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't get scanned into our system. It's a yellow form, and you take it from hospital to hospital to hospital to a nursing home to your doctor's office. And you update it as you need to.
Yeah, that's something else that I wanted to emphasize. Mm-hmm. People tend to think, you know, when they hear the word will, for example, keeping in a safe deposit box. But these should not – well, you can keep one. These should be kept in a very prominent place, and as you mentioned, on bright-colored paper.
On bright-colored paper, we encourage people to put them on their refrigerator because if you call the ambulance, that's where those guys are going to look for it, on the refrigerator.
Does this document have some legal teeth to it?
It's a physician order, so yes, it does. Mm-hmm. It does.
So if a family member comes in and says, I want to do things differently, this document will stand.
This document can help to stand with that as well as your advance directive, your living will. It all works together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, you've mentioned that Joni is the one that helps people have conversations about mm-hmm. with their relatives or to think these things through for themselves. Mm-hmm. Do you do that also?
Yes, because we, by nature, don't want to talk about those things until we absolutely have
right.
to. So even in palliative care or people that have had long-term chronic illnesses that their physician has treated for many years, they still don't want to have those conversations until they absolutely need to. So we as hospice nurses, social workers, different people are often the first ones to have those conversations. What are your goals? What do you want to happen if your disease continues to progress?
Can you get, I know you can't mention specifics or anything, but can you mm-hmm. give some examples of how a conversation, the typical conversation that helps guide someone through? Because I looked at these forms. There's things I hadn't thought about or I mm-hmm. don't feel I know enough about. I'd have mm-hmm. to know more about what was wrong with me at that point. I wouldn't know how to fill them in, really. Mm-hmm. Like, do not resuscitate stuck in my mind. Because mm-hmm. if I was half drowned, I'd want to be
right.
resuscitated.
Right.
But if I was sort of dying of cancer, I wouldn't. So, you know, it's not a simple question to answer.
It's not. And in general, people aren't filling out those forms until they have a chronic illness.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can be very specific with them. I know we've talked before about the five wishes where you can be very specific. If you have Alzheimer's, I want this done. If I have heart disease, if I'm in a car accident, there's different things you can be very specific with.
Is this a form that most doctors introduce to their patients proactively?
I many do, mm-hmm. but physicians have difficulty speaking about death and dying as well.
As well as other people do.
As
and
well
also,
as we all do.
And also, I mean, this has been in the news recently, too. They have not been usually reimbursed for having these conversations, which take a lot of time.
Yes, they do.
There's a new proposal mm-hmm. By the National Department of Health and Human Services, I believe, mm-hmm. about mm-hmm. that.
It start January 1 of 2016. They will be in getting reimbursed for those conversations to have with the patients and the families. Mm-hmm. So hopefully we will see a huge influx in that conversation and how and when they're talking to their patients.
Yeah, and of course, these are completely voluntary conversations.
Yes.
That the patient wants to have.
Yes.
But the physician will be reimbursed mm-hmm. for spending time mm-hmm. talking about these things. But as you say, we don't like to think about these things. We don't like to talk about them.
No.
But they are very important.
Do you recommend that any person bring this up with their physician?
Yes. Any time you have a chronic illness, absolutely, I would encourage you to ask. I would talk about living will, do not resuscitate, the iPost, any of those things. I would have those conversations mm-hmm. as soon as possible. Being a hospice nurse for as many years as I have, my kids know everything and anything that I want done. But unless you
and
work in that.
And she looks very young, I wonder. I want our listeners to know.
She does not look like she has a chronic illness.
No, no. But it's never too soon to have those conversations.
That's
so
right.
that your kids and your family know what you want and how you want it. Because that really is key mm-hmm. to them supporting your decisions is having them know what you want.
And probably in getting along with each other as well,
yes.
Right?
Right.
Yes.
If there's a lot of
yes.
children.
If there's a lot of kids, you can have six on page and one not. And that one can really influence and cause some problems with those other
yeah,
six.
Yeah, it could be a child that's been abroad or hasn't seen the parent for mm-hmm. a while or mm-hmm. all sorts of things.
So in your work in hospice mm-hmm. or in I guess you're more on the referral end of it. Mm-hmm. But do you see that there's a lot of need to deal with the needs of the family as well as the person who's actually dying?
I would say that 90% is with the family.
Can you explain?
And supporting. As a patient, when we are sick, and you can think of this in, even when you have a cold or the flu or something minor, when you're sick, that's very internal. You kind of deal with yourself and, you know, oh, well, if I just, you know, rest for a couple of days, I'll be fine. But with a terminal illness, you're more at ease with that because you've heard it. You know how you feel. You know how you're dealing with it on a day to day. Your family, on the other hand, aren't quite usually where you're at with that illness. They're not understanding it. They're not seeing the pain. They're not seeing the discomfort that comes along with that. So they're very emotional. They're very uneasy. They have a lot of questions. They haven't been at all of the doctor's appointments. They haven't been at all of those things and followed that as closely as the patient has. So we oftentimes have to get them caught up with where the patient is in the illness. Those children abroad or those people that haven't been real close.
Yeah, and I think I've read somewhere that people hear the term hospice and children are liable to say, oh, that's giving up.
Mm-hmm. Always.
Whereas it isn't
always.
At all.
I would say a large amount of people feel that is giving up. And there is a sense of giving up.
It is in a sense, yes. Sometimes you need to give up.
You do. Your body. It's not you spiritually or mentally giving up. It's your body is giving up. And so there is a difference. I talk to families about changing the focus, not from the body giving up, but to just allowing death to occur, to be comfortable, to allow that to happen.
What do you see as the most powerful way to help people accept that? What do you say to them, or what do you do that helps them make that transition?
I don't know if I can tell you one.
It's different with everybody.
It's different and that's those goals,
right?
And that's what we focus on.
Goals and wishes.
And that's always you asked earlier about how do you start that conversation, and that's most often how I start that conversation. This is your illness. What is your goal? What do you want to see happening? And oftentimes this is the first time they've thought about that. And oftentimes they'll say, well, my goal is to do this, this, and this treatment-wise. Let's try this. Well, then we're going to go in a different direction if that's the case. If the goal is to make it to a wedding next month and be as comfortable as possible and not be in and out of the hospital, we're going to go that direction. So that's how I
most often. Or it might be make it to see my grandchild. Or it might be I want to be at home with my family.
I want to be at home. Or, you know, we've had lots of different goals.
So when you say goals and wishes, you're talking about what the goals are of the person who's dying, what they need to do before they die.
What they need to do, what they need to accomplish, mm-hmm. who they need to talk to, who they need to see. It can be all sorts of different.
And do you find that focusing the family on those goals helps them go
yes.
through the process?
Yes. And it helps them to get up to where that patient is, getting caught up. You know, mm-hmm. if they know that their mom's goal is to see a sibling, or then they will help to rally to get that done, and then that starts that conversation.
Mm-hmm. So it unites them under, gives them a mission, gives them mm-hmm. something they can
something
do,
something to focus on, something mm-hmm. to do. Yes,
yeah, that's very interesting.
Yeah, and you mentioned before five wishes.
Mm-hmm.
Could you say something about that?
The five wishes is just a very in-depth living will.
Oh, okay.
Talks about who can make decisions. It talks about if I'm in bed dying and I have days to weeks, do I want music and what kind of music? Do I want a lot of friends and family? Do I just want my spouse? It's very specific mm-hmm. needs. And it just goes through, and it has different illnesses. Like I mentioned, if you have dementia, I want these things. If I have heart disease, if I have cancer, if I was in a car accident,
uh-huh.
very specific, detailed.
Yeah. Now, one of the thing that a lot of people are dealing with these days, including my family, is a case of Alzheimer's, where you mm-hmm. really are dealing with somebody where you don't have the capacity to ask them these questions.
Right.
And you don't really have specific goals you can accomplish because the person can't tell you right. if they even have any goals at that point. What do you do for families with Alzheimer's patients? It's a very vague kind of situation.
Well, first of all, you wanted to have those conversations before they weren't able to make those decisions. That's why it's important to do that when we're young.
Mm-hmm.
And to be able to voice those things. And then we talk a lot about when that person was able to make decisions. Do you remember them saying, I don't want this done, or if I ever get to that point, I don't want this, or I do want that. If they've had experiences with other people in their life and you remember them saying, well, I don't want to do what Joe did if he had this, try to pull those things together and have conversation about those. And family knows the most about their loved one. So we really have to trust and get them all on the same page
mm-hmm.
And just have that conversation.
Do you find this work inspiring or depressing?
I think this is my 15th year. I think that it's not depressing. I get much more inspiration and joy and hope and than any depression. Yes, some days you cry. Some days absolutely. But in general, it's much more hopeful. You see the best of people
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and their families.
It's a very mm-hmm. profound moment.
It is. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is. It's if you look at the end of the other end of the spectrum, you can give birth and that's very profound. But as you care for somebody that's dying in their family, it's just a peaceful.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a good. It's a comforting time for them mm-hmm. to be able to be there for that.
And talking of peaceful, could you describe the experience, say, of being at Israel Hospice House? It's not like a hospital room, is it?
It's not.
It looks very nice place when you drive by. It's a nice building, but I've never seen inside.
It's very homey, I've been out there about 8 years, and even after all these years, if it's been a horrible day and it's emotional, and you walk through their doors, and it's very peaceful and comforting.
And bird feeders and things.
Bird feeders in all the windows. They're big rooms. They're armoire and TV, and it's not like a hospital room. We don't have plugs and stuff coming out of the wall. Big family rooms, nice, wallpaper and carpeting, and just a very nice, comfortable mm-hmm. place. It's kind of like a fancy hotel.
Now, I've heard people that have graduated from hospice. In other words, they've recovered. And this is why? Why does this happen?
Oh, I think that there's many reasons. I think that we give really good care.
Miracle.
I think miracles do happen. I'm a believer. I think oftentimes we have patients that have long-term chronic illnesses, heart disease, for instance, that have been on medications for 20, 30 years, and we kind of scale down those medications because they've chosen that. They've wanted to, you know, let's get rid of some of these things. And they seem to get better. I don't know what the answer is. I think a lot of it is that there's just...
Well, I just read something recently. There's a book called Being Mortal by Atul Gat. What, do you know that?
I do.
Yeah, who's a surgeon as well as an author. And the several studies, one study, for example, shows that people that, quote, give up and go into hospitals live 25% longer than those that don't give up.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, yeah. People live longer in hospice than they do acute care.
Yeah,
Their pain's better managed.
Because they're more at ease.
They're more at ease. Their pain's better managed. They're all of their symptoms are better managed. And pain shortens our life. So if we can relieve that pain and allow that patient to enjoy and spend time with families, they do live longer.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a pleasant note to end on, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, can I share with you real briefly my grandfather's death?
Absolutely.
Because having spoken with you, I feel like we did some things right. He was actually put in a nursing home by his family, and it became clear in a nursing home that he was going to die. And it wasn't clear whether the nursing home was killing him or whether he was going to die anyway. It was kind of 50-50. But in any case, his goal was to go home so that he could die in the presence of his wife. And we did manage to do that. So I feel good because we did accomplish really his main goal, which was to die at home.
To be at home.
And so he did that. But the other thing that was, in a way, kind of the moment that helped me as a family member accept that he was dying, it was a very funny situation because I was very good friends with him. So it was very hard for me to accept that he was leaving. And it was clear that he was dying because he stopped speaking. He just shut down and wouldn't talk anymore and seemed very focused on dying. And, of course, I felt very left out because he was my friend. And he was very, very thin because he had become very emaciated. And he was lying on he had a couch in his study where he would lie every afternoon. And he was lying on the couch and he was shivering because he was so cold. And so I had this idea, well, as his friend, I was going to lie down next to him to give him warmth. He was, by the way, a Calvinist minister, okay? And so I lay down on the couch next to him, and he leaned over, and he indicated that he wanted to tell me something. And I got really excited because I thought, oh, he's going to, you know, last words, you know, he's going to say something to me. He's going to tell me he loves me or something. So I leaned over with with great expectation, and he leans over and he says to me, "Get off my couch."
he hadn't spoken for a while, remember?
You know, and my father, he was very insightful. He says, "Well, you know, that's obvious. Here's this guy. He's been a minister all his life. He's like 2 seconds from heaven's gate, and like this young woman lies down on his couch with him." You know, so so anyway, needless to say, I was pretty embarrassed in the moment, but I was actually very reassured because it made clear to me that my grandfather was still my grandfather and that even when you're dying, it doesn't change who you are. No. You are who you are, and he was himself until he died, and he had his principles, and it did not include having his grandchild lie on a couch with him. So, so it kind of brought me back to reality.
Cute.
So... anyway.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. Thanks for that story, Ursula. And thank you, Alicia, for coming.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's
You're
very
welcome.
Nice to have you. And this is part of our community service appreciation segments that Kay does. And thank you, Kay, for where we discuss the services that are really available in our community. And this is an important service to know about. It really is.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
And I agree. I think... you know, thinking about these things and writing them down in advance, I'm really glad you brought that to our attention because it's something that you don't normally think about. Yeah.
It's key.
It's
for
key.
All of us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, again, just to review, what is that called?
Oh, you mean the forms?
Yeah, the forms.
Well, the iPost is the...
iPost.
And Living Will Advanced Directives. I guess Advanced Directives is the general term
for all of them. Is the general term for all of them.
And this is something you can request through your physician.
You can visit with your physician about, yes.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for coming. You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we bring stories, people, and events in central Iowa. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, one of your hosts for today, together with Kay Patak. And we would like to introduce our second guest for the show today, Ginwa Alamin, who is an instructor in Arabic at Iowa State University and who's joining us from Denver. Normally she's in Ames, but we managed to reach her in Denver, where she's attending a professional conference. Welcome.
Hi, Ursula and Kay.
Hello.
Hi, Kay. Let me just check with you again. Your name is pronounced Ginwa?
Yep.
Okay, great. I want to make sure I get that G right. Thank you.
Well, that's the closest you can get. Yeah.
thank you so much for taking time to speak with us.
You're welcome. I'm so happy to be here.
Yeah, it's a very, very interesting story and events, and also it's very interesting work you're doing at Iowa State. And so would you begin by just telling us a bit about where you're at and what you're doing at the conference in Denver?
Well, I'm in Denver attending and presenting in the MESA conference, which is the Middle East Studies Association conference, and have presented in a panel held in conjunction by the American Association of Arabic Teachers. It's an organization that facilitates communication between teachers of Arabic in the United States and promotes the study and research of Arabic language. So my presentation was about teaching pronunciation beyond the 101 Arabic classes, because most of the teaching of pronunciation has been done only in the introductory class, but after that, students are not exposed to pronunciation instruction, and they're left alone usually to handle their pronunciation problems.
And the pronunciation of Arabic is very different from what people are accustomed to in the United States?
Right, yeah. It's... I mean, we have sounds, and it's an alphabetical language, but still a lot of the sounds, especially the consonants, are really different from the English ones. Like, for example, the one, my name. So if you want to say my name, it would be Ginwa.
Ginwa.
Right.
Huh.
You
nice.
Have other sounds where you have really to stretch your muscles, like ha and ah. and students take a lot of time to get used to using muscles they have not used before in their life.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Right. So the problem was, and I showed that in my presentation, is that the most popular textbooks in the United States only cover pronunciation for 3 to 6 weeks, and that's it. I showed them in numbers that there was almost none exposure, no exercises after that throughout the whole study. And then I gave recommendations of how to go around this problem.
Hmm. Well, I'll try the quinoa. I'm trying here. You've recently been reinstated as an instructor at Iowa State after troubles and delays with your work permit were finally sorted out, thanks in part to the support of your students. And we'll get back to the subject of your students later. But first, could you fill in the background of the events that led up to these troubles with the work permit?
Right, yeah. So I have a work permit that lasts for 18 months, and then so you reapply for renewal every time it's about to expire. So I applied for that in February, and usually this is a process that takes between 2 to 3 months, that's what happened before. But this time I just waited and waited, and it came to the time where it had to where it expired, and I had to stop working at the end of September, and I've never heard anything about it.
Hmm.
And then eventually I had to stop working because you can't work without a work permit.
Now, I just in case some of our listeners are confused, as I was a bit at first, this is not, you weren't in danger of being deported. You could stay here, but you just couldn't work here. That's right,
right.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. I was in illegal status, but it's just I could not work without a valid work permit. And it's, I mean, usually it's just, this should not happen as long as you get it renewed. But if your papers had not arrived, then you can't actually work.
Now, this is all necessary because you're not an American citizen, correct?
This is because you're not an American citizen.
What country are you a citizen of?
Syria.
And how long have you been in the United States?
This is my 11th year.
Wow. So this is a process that has to be revisited periodically when you're...
Right.
every 8 months, did you say? You've been doing
18.
This every 18, 18 months.
Like a year and a half, yeah.
Every 18 months, you've been doing this for 11 years.
Well, I've moved between statuses because I've been a student, and, you know, once you're done being a student, you move to a different status.
Oh, I see,
so,
I see.
Yeah.
Wow, so this is an indefinite process that you have to continue as long as you're a landed immigrant?
There are different immigrant statuses, and mm-hmm. this is the one that I am in.
Mm-hmm.
And it requires, in my situation, a renewal every 18 months.
Hmm. I see.
Right, but different people have different situations.
Sure.
Did you come to Iowa State as a student?
Yep, I came here in 2015, long time ago it seems now.
Yeah.
And I did my MA and then my PhD in the Applied Linguistics and Technology program here at Iowa State.
And are you a professor or an adjunct professor, or what is your status with the university?
I'm a lecturer.
A lecturer. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you for giving background just to help us understand.
Yeah,
who you are.
And let's get to the subject of your students and what they did. They were very anxious to have you back at Iowa State, and they worked hard to bring that about. And I guess the university authorities were quite helpful too. Could you talk a bit about the steps that people took, the students and other people, to help reinstate you and get your paperwork hurried up?
Right, yeah. First of all, I, just like you at the beginning, I didn't know about it, especially that I live in Des Moines. At the beginning, I announced news to my students on my last day of work, and I said that this is my last day, and they were really shocked. And then I'd never see them. But occasionally when I came back to do some of the health sessions, and when I came back eventually, they talked to me about what they have done. And I've learned about all the collaboration efforts they put together, asked students to write petitions. So they wrote petitions, and they sent them to university officials, state, national officials to urge them to help in my case and expedite the process. I don't know how they kind of collected the information and reached out to different people, but eventually more than 100 people, I was told, signed these petitions, and these were mostly my students, but also they reached out to former students, other members in the community also who had interest in the Arabic program.
That's a that's quite a story. Yeah, that's quite a story. Clearly, they were very motivated to do something about this, which says something about the quality of your teaching.
Yes.
Well, yeah, I hope so. It's just so amazing to see how students can, you know, these are students who don't have a lot of experience in such things like writing petitions and getting mobilized and organized in such efforts. So it's really, it makes your heart grow when you see such efforts made in your on your behalf. So that was really moving.
How did you find out that they had done all this?
Well, I came back to university a little time after I stopped working just to, offering help sessions, and some of them mentioned that. But then when I came back to teaching, they just told me the whole story.
Yeah, and about, I think it was about a month, wasn't it, that elapsed between the time you had to quit teaching officially and you were reinstated. And you've sort of touched on this a bit, but you took steps to keep in touch with your students in that time and keep them up with their studies. Would you like to talk a little about that?
Yeah,
that shows extra dedication there.
Right. I mean, I couldn't do a lot. I mean, I initially, when I heard that I couldn't teach, I offered to teach the classes for free, but that's not allowed by university policies. So I had to step out. But what I did, I just offered, you know, help sessions outside the classroom, whoever wanted to just drop in, and also try to stay connected to the students through our Blackboard website and offer, you know, advice and announcements for different study abroad programs. Kept writing the recommendation letters and helping individual students with their letters and things like that. And I also kept helping connecting them with the our Arab Student Association. We have several activities that connect the two parties also. So,
what kind of students are studying Arabic? Who is there a way to describe who ends up studying Arabic?
Usually they are so motivated students. That's the way I describe them.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you think about studying another language, usually students go for Spanish. But when you want to study a less taught language, and which sometimes thought by people as a challenging language, then you really find motivated students who are eager to learn, and I'm so proud of them. But they come from, you know, varied backgrounds. A lot of them are majoring in things like international studies and political science and have interest in the Middle East, naturally.
Mm-hmm.
But I also have several students, for example, doing global resource management, business, because when you have potential clients from the Middle East, agriculture is also a field where I've been having more and more interest from students. And also you have heritage students who want to reestablish connections with their extended families, and or I have students also who want to learn Arabic to understand the Quran, that's the holy book of Muslims written in Arabic, to understand it better. So, and sometimes you have students who are just, they tell me, I have friends who speak Arabic, or I just want it to be different and study something that not a lot of people know of, you know, to have this different things on your resume and find better career opportunities.
Hmm. Are most of your students Americans?
Yes, most of them are Arabic.
Do you think that there is an increased interest in an awareness of Arabic languages and cultures?
Oh, In the United States, mm-hmm. Arabic is by far the language that grew the most from all the foreign languages in the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. So it's the, I don't remember exactly the number, but between 2006 and 2009, that's the last survey I think they did, there was an increase about 45% of the numbers of students in the United States studying.
That's very interesting.
And at Iowa State, I believe the Arabic language program has doubled. Didn't you say it's doubled in the last, or I read somewhere it's doubled in the last two years?
In the last 2 years, we opened another section, and usually both our 101 sections are full last year and this year, and also this year our 102 classes also doubled its number. It's obviously a lot of people are more aware these days of the importance of Arabic language for a lot. I mean, it's the fifth most commonly spoken language in the world with 315 million speakers at least. And it opens a lot of doors for you in terms of career, because in the United States, it's considered to be a language of strategic importance.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
It's been designated as a critical language by the federal government.
Well, clearly the way your students responded to your situation indicates the high level of motivation to study this language and clearly not to have studies interrupted. Because they really wanted to continue working with you. So it really shows the level of motivation being shown these days.
I think we've got a couple of minutes or so left here. You're obviously, as Ursula said, a instructor that earns great loyalty from your students. Could you, for a few minutes, describe your teaching philosophy and maybe some of the important areas of research? And you've got innovative ways of teaching, too. Would you like to talk about some of that?
Excuse me. So my teaching philosophy, it kind of developed over my 17 years of teaching experience, because I came from an educational system that is heavily based on memorization. Mm-hmm. And then it just changed into I knew what not to do with my students. Instead of just forcing them to do things, you become the facilitator in the classroom. You want them to learn things and be in control of their learning. So, especially with foreign language, I'm not going to be there for them all their life. They have to know how to teach themselves and how to use certain strategies. So I teach them strategies to learn instead of just teaching them specific items. And I also try to create learner community by having them work together in groups on a lot of different projects over the semester, and also engaging them with native speakers. I also have several programs like a language partnership program, and we have the conversation table. So I try to bring the two communities together, my learners and the native Arabic community also, to work together, and so that they have a real-life situation where they can use the language, because we don't live in an Arabic country. So that helps them a lot. And I also always solicit feedback from my students throughout the process, because I want to hear from them. So, for example, if I was producing a booklet about Arabic verbs, so I give them drafts and they give me feedback and then I fix it. And you know, it's just a reciprocal process where you have to work closely with the students.
You said that you also have a connection between your class and an Arabic club at the university. Is that correct?
Right. It's the Arab Student Association. We started that last year. They are just an energetic group of students, and it includes both anybody who's interested in Arabic culture and language. So anyone can join this group, including Arab Native speakers and also my students and anyone else who has an interest. So, and they have a lot of events they held, like, for example, a soccer tournament, Kora, the last semester, and Arab culture nights, and again, they are involved in all of these programs that I have mentioned to you to promote the Arabic language and culture.
That's very interesting. Quinoa?
Quinoa, yeah.
You've also done some very innovative programs in terms of research in various areas. We're kind of running out of time for the radio show, so can we convince you to come back and discuss more at length the various research that you've done in the area of language?
Sure, I'd love to. Yeah,
okay. Yeah, maybe
we can get you here in person.
Maybe, since you're from Syria, we can get you to talk about Syria in the future if you'd be willing to do that. Would that be a possibility?
Yeah, we could talk about that, sure.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much for taking time for joining us today. And
so early in the morning for you, too.
Yes. And hopefully we can...
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, hopefully we can have you here in person sometime in the near future. It sounds like you're part of what we would call hidden treasures in Ames. That's really...
Yeah.
Well,
really,
thank you so much for the compliment. Yeah, thank you for the program and for such a thoughtful questions and discussion.
Okay, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank
You're
you.
Have
Bye-bye.
A very good day. Bye-bye. So this is Local Talk, and I think that's it for the show. Mm-hmm. This is Local Talk, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. And this is a new area to explore for us. And Kay Patak, you've been my host today. Thank you, and for planning the show. And my name is Ursula Rudenberg. Today we heard about hospice care from Alicia Krabel, who specializes in this type of care at Mary Greeley Medical Center. And we also heard from Khinwa Alamin, and she's an Arabic instructor at Iowa State University in World Languages and Cultures. And thanks largely to the overwhelming support from her students, she was able to solve some bureaucratic mix-ups that put her back at work at Iowa State. And she's been reinstated in her position as a lecturer.
Our theme song is Backtracking by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show. If you'd like to join our team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878. That's 292-2878. Or contact us through our website, khoifm.org. If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends and check us out on Facebook.
Also, we'd like to thank you, all of you who have donated in the past week. We are just coming to the end of our pledge drive for membership at KHOI, and thank you to everybody who's donated. And if you have not donated yet, please consider. We still need the money.
We sure do.
So keep it coming, please. It's definitely not too late to donate to KHOI. And a $55 membership or a $100 membership. And you can do that very easily by going online at khoifm.org. Please think of us as the year comes to an end.
And you can listen to this show and all our past Local Talk shows online or at our website, khoifm.org. You can find today's show on our homepage as soon as our webmaster, Ron Carson, is able to post it. KHOI is now streaming online at khoifm.org, where you can also find archives of KHOI's past shows. And please remember that you as a listener are the most important part of Local Talk. Your participation as an audience and your generous donations help make it all possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.